I begin this morning with D.H. Lawrence's famous call for a poetry of the present. "Don't give me the infinite or the eternal," wrote Lawrence. "Say nothing of infinity, nothing of eternity. Give me the still, white, seething, the incandescence and the coldness of the incarnate moment, the moment, the quick of all change and haste and opposition, the moment, the immediate present, the now." It occurs to me that little by little our conscious lives are being transformed by our smartphones and tablets, so that in our perhaps obsessive pursuit of the moment, many of us are becoming as unconscious Buddhists living in the midst of this crazy, self-disclosing, trend-obsessed culture of ours. Certainly the quick of all change and haste and even opposition is with us in spades in all the ways we cultivate our connections, which for many are the currency of their e-lives. It's been plausibly said that in all of human history, there has never been so much access to the relatively raw contents of other minds. They mostly turn out, as it happens, to be as limited as our own. In truth, it's amazing how public many of us have become. On Facebook and the other sharing sites, from Reddit to Twitter, on our laptops and smartphones, with tons of content that we now routinely share, and it does make a difference to the quality of our lives. The photographs we now can see and share, and the videos. We're connected to the moment more profoundly than ever before, and though we're in more contact with other minds than ever before, we still know so very little. Consciousness, the great gift, is almost entirely mysterious. The side effect, perhaps, of a physiological accident that happened a couple billion years ago, when light and its chemistry became indispensable at the cellular level to living substances. So much so that substance was able to grow vast in its diversity and eventual intelligence. So much so that in the highest animals, it actually became aware of itself. Wow. Cellular biology and neurophysiology keep improving all the time, but we're still largely ignorant when it comes to explaining conscious experience, let alone the richness of the tapestry of visual and auditory and sensory awareness. We've learned to understand that our minds are somehow the consequence of brain activity, and we know just how fragile the apparatus of our senses and memory and understanding actually are. But consider what we do know about the mechanics of consciousness. According to psychophysicists and cognitive researchers, each of us operates at the center of our personal temporality, experiencing the present in increments that last roughly 3 seconds, with a resonating sense of time extending through a functional moment that lasts roughly 78 seconds, or 1.3 minutes. To be sure, it has never been easy to imagine where the present moment begins and where it ends. If we think about it, what we know is not very far from St. Augustine's 1,500-year-old assessment of time consciousness, which feels very contemporary, even relativistic, in the sense that Einstein developed with great difficulty and the deepest mathematics. "If any portion of time be conceived which cannot now be divided into even the minutest particles of moments," writes Augustine, "this only is that which may be called present, which flies so rapidly from future to past that it cannot be extended by any delay. For if it be extended, it is divided into the past and future, but the present has no space." For human beings, time's arrow moves along a narrow window of the functional moment, that place where each individual finds and belongs to herself. How this happens will be the subject of this morning's discussion. Mind you, I have almost no answers, mostly questions, concerning what to make of my own experience of time and consciousness. If anything, I'm buzzing on a new frequency, and I'm unsure as to whether its nature is philosophical, theological, poetical, or if such distinctions even matter. One thing does seem certain, as I get older, is that I'm increasingly aware of the precious nature and fragility of the consciousness I do possess. I find in particular that understanding time, shaking the branches of whatever about physics and philosophy of mind that I'm able to understand, and the many related questions they raise, suddenly mean more than I ever realized. In an earlier sermon, I spoke about the illusion of self, which seems to have started my engine in this direction. But a certain mutability that I've experienced recently in my personal life has contributed more than a little urgency. I feel an intense need to know more, and that led me to Daniel Dennett, whose 1992 book, Consciousness Explained, expounds on his very compelling multiple drafts model of consciousness. His idea is that conscious life is a fragmentary and provisional process that we experience as multiple drafts, versions, if you will, of a continuously moving narrative that accrues as we process the details of our unfolding heterogeneous moments. It is a process in which no one set of inputs operates in any kind of central location, either of anatomical activity, attention, or importance, except as it might seem to us at any given moment. Confusing, slippery stuff to think about, but it's fun too, I think. Who has not felt themselves composing their lives in piecemeal? Sometimes quite under control and successfully continuous in its consistency, while at other times it seems a hodgepodge of impressions proceeding very much by improvisation. Having only recently encountered Dennett, I'm insufficiently familiar with the arc of his writings to comment at any length, only that he seems to have ignited an amazing argument, unbelievable argument, among his contemporary consciousness researchers and philosophers. However, I can say that his investigation into the nature of consciousness as consisting in multiple drafts, whose unfinished features are assembled as we pass through the minutes of our lives, is particularly interesting to me, especially as a writer. What a vision he presents, that mindful living involves us in a continuing process of awakening to the shape of our experience as we find our way through time and our environments, assembling our conscious lives as we go. Not so very different from Buddhist practice, I would say, but entirely empirical, almost anti-spiritual in its conduct as he describes it. The multiple drafts model, he writes, makes the process of writing down in memory criterial for consciousness, creating as we go a map of what it is for the given to be taken. Memory provides the anchor of consciousness in ways that we don't at first realize as it registers and writes down the physical enactments of sense experience, and not as a kind of sequel or after effect of the brain's network activity, but the network itself in the act of networking. Think about that metaphor for a moment. We are each of us a hive of network activity, in which case consciousness becomes both medium and message, to paraphrase McLuhan, serving as the vehicle of life's content in a way that our senses and the data they apprehend and process form both the essence of awareness itself and the effects they register. Short-term memory and working memory, they are a little different, carry a great deal of freight of daily living. And some of us who have aging parents who have learned the hard way that when undermined by disease or trauma, the failure of immediate working memory can steal a person's sense of who they are as a confident creature who makes sense and has a purpose. But memory and its many manifestations as the vehicle of life's content is also the principal material for any investigation into what is meant by mindfulness, especially as we seek to discover meaning in the sense of having and leading spiritual lives without a deity or a creed to hold us up. According to Dennett, Consciousness happens without mediation, such that what we see and hear and become are at once the given of our being, the how and who we are, that manage to form together what we experience as a continuous, more or less unified present moment. Nevertheless, in spite of the microclimate, if you will, of the presentness of apprehension, what fascinates me and makes me hopeful is that what we are able to fashion and give shape and history and meaning to as we form the drafts of our being. As a writer, I have a profound and growing respect for the power of a sympathetic imagination and what John Keats called negative capability, which involves the willingness to inhabit, to imagine and inhabit other minds, tolerating their otherness, even to the point of celebrating their contradiction while embracing the drama of difference that this contradiction brings. First, because a sympathetic imagination is what gives birth to compassion, but also because it can be argued that it is the source of all genuine creativity, starting with a raw but profound alertness to the wonderful, stubborn presence of reality. Dennett, in looking deeply into sense and memory, gives us a basis for trusting what our memories are able to respond to and write down as we create narratives of being that we keep and share with our companions and our children. And while I'm sure that Dennett's concept of consciousness as unfolding in multiple drafts is designed to describe the micro-mechanics of the processes of consciousness as he finds it, I find myself rather happily adopting its framework to considerations of good old-fashioned storytelling, giving more finished and more craftsman-like considerations of language and writing their due as a frontline activity in the recovery of memory and experience, but which I have to say is decidedly less granular about its practices and technical vocabulary. This is the point in our discussion where I'd like to segue from micro to macro and from moment-by-moment shaping of the given into considering how we assemble our drafts into something like identity, or what John Keats described as soul-making. There are several steps involved. First, some definitions are in order and some clarifications. I am talking about themes and definitions that people in the literary world especially have been applying to memoir, which has become a very popular literary form. Perhaps it's the zeitgeist, but there's a reason why it's become fashionable to be writing one's memoirs and reading those of other people. And I think that there is something about the unsettling speed of contemporary life that compels many of us to anchor ourselves in narrative. The truer and closest to our own stories, the better. Journaling, after all, is something everyone can do. Trying one's thoughts, recording what can be framed and understood about one's experience in a way that encourages us to dwell on matters of the moment. Today, we call them blogs, and no one thinks they're especially profound. My only hope is that we learn to preserve these accounts of our time somehow in our electronic storehouses, because a century from now, they will be like our great-grandparents' correspondence, because it's our messages to one another that are really the only window anyone ever has into the deeper past. Dennett reminds us that his registration of reality as multiple drafts is in no way especially clean and unitary in the sense of a photographic memory, in the sense of a photographic record. And it's true, as good as certain gifted individuals can be with their photographic memories and eidetic imagery, most of us are intrinsically provisional in our sense-making. And this gets reflected in our narratives. We are creatures of trial and error, and what could be more human than that? More to the point, the truth of an experience, however particular, is and will be subject to more or less continuous revision in the sense that we write down its appurtenances in piecemeal rather than a single transcendent blast of apprehension. To be sure, on rare occasions, charismatic events happen to everyone, and often enough in everyone's life to keep us enthusiastic about what Wordsworth called spots of time, whose moments of meaning illuminate our lives. However, it remains the case that for most of us, most of the time, the norm is more normal and apprehension duller and more deliberate, which means in the end that we typically grasp our experiences disjointedly in fragments, more often than not piecing them together more or less on the fly. And this is what makes the act of writing down our experiences so difficult. In the macro and micro worlds of writing down experience, selection governs everything, and talent turns out to be a gift for choosing compelling details, the sexy bits, if you will, that stimulate people's imaginations, and that everyone prefers to read. And this takes us to a definition that I hope will illustrate both the challenge and the opportunity that comes with paying close attention to the content of our experience. Among Dennett's contributions to his examination, to his re-examination of certain very useful terms of philosophical vocabulary, one of them, qualia, keeps improving in usefulness. Once I get past the word's Latinate technocratic buzz, derived from the adverb qualis, which means what sort, what kind, and always plural, qualia are subjective experiences that we can't describe so much as declare to others in the expectation of empathy and recognition. Qualia, Dennis tells us, is an unfamiliar term for the ways things seem to us. There are many definitions which have changed over time. One of the simplest is, what is it like? Is the what is it like character of mental states. The way it feels to have the experience of a migraine, seeing red, smelling a rose, for example. According to Dennett, qualia have four fundamental properties. They are inevitable, they are ineffable, and in some ways mysterious, such that they cannot be communicated or apprehended by any other means than direct experience. They are intrinsic, that is, they consist of non-relational properties. It's technical stuff, but there it is. They are private, that is, all interpersonal comparisons of qualia are systematically impossible. And finally, directly or immediately apprehensible in consciousness. That is, to experience a qualia is to know the experience as a quality, and to know all there is to know about that quality. Now here again, as an artist, I have to quarrel somewhat with Dennett's attributes. I would contend, for example, that one person's ineffable is another's familiar turf. Writers like Baudelaire, for example, or Tolstoy, or a painter like Van Gogh, these masters of edgy defamiliarization, come to mind as eminently capable of domesticating the so-called ineffable, who turn the ordinary into something close to visionary, or conversely, turn the unprecedented or unimagined into the comprehensible, making the familiar strange, or else the strange, strangely familiar. Philosophically, it seems to me that we get in trouble when we insist too strongly on the privacy of private experience, or give too much credence to the incommunicability of certain powerful experiences. I would argue that among the purposes of art is the capture of time itself, to grasp the ephemeral so as to hold it in the mind, enabling the personal features of experience to acquire something like universal currency. In essence, to give the unspeakable a name. To render light, for example, the way that Rembrandt or Caravaggio was able to apprehend its special mystery, its majesty and beauty. The fact that we can't always succeed sustains, perhaps, the philosopher's concept of the ineluctable qualia, but that doesn't guarantee its insurmountability. This imparting of substance might just be where soul-making could be said to happen. No one doubts that experience changes us and makes us larger or more capable of feeling the world as it is or as it might be. It should be said as well that our experiences are capable of shattering us. Who would deny, for example, that infantry combat at its most horrific is not transformative for worse as well as better? Having accepted this fact, I would argue that the intersubjective nature of language itself is what imparts to us the ability to test the limits of what can and can't be said. If we think about powerful, shapely utterance as the fuel, if you will, Keats' idea of negative capability can be understood as a very real engine of discovery. How else do poets proceed and succeed the ways they do? Empathy and imagination delve into the experience of reality to feed one another, so that what might be deemed ineluctably private may not be such a locked cabinet as Dennett would suggest. Negative capability, described by Keats as occurring when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. In Keats' mind, this was in no way a form of irrationalism, but rather it's an account of the ways the imagination operates, especially under duress, as when conditions are uncertain and the humanity of the circumstances outweighs the sense that a given state of affairs ought to have one just and suitable outcome. Contraries in this negative capable condition are seen to stand in precarious balance, as if for a moment they are as much siblings as adversaries. With Shakespeare's Hamlet never far from his mind, Keats' negative capability became for him a method of suspending disbelief as well as judgment, while allowing contradictions to play out in conditions that where they are fully at odds with one another, and yet somehow remaining detached, at least for a moment, from the need for reconciliation. Keats' practice was characteristically humane, conditioned by his horrific personal situation, as first his mother and then his brother Thomas succumbed to the tuberculosis that was to take his life at the age of 25. Above all, Keats was interested in creating bridges of sensibility between contradictory states of mind. His goal was to be a great poet in the model of Shakespeare, and negative capability at bottom was a method of appropriating what he believed to be the nexus of Shakespearean art. And for him, it clearly worked. In the same year that he wrote that letter, 1819, Keats produced all his great odes: To Psyche, To a Nightingale, To Melancholy, On a Grecian Urn, The Ode to Autumn, which constitute his extraordinary, if very brief, and matchless poetic maturity. The capacity to embrace contradiction and adversity through the power of negative capability carried as well into the notion of soul-making, which he described in his famous letter to his brother George, which we read earlier. I can think of no better example than Keats of a mind operating with every channel open to what the universe offers as he strives to form a successful attitude against what he knew to be a terminal illness. I would follow Keats in embracing negative capability as a term, if not a method, enabling us to overcome the isolation of so much human experience. Young as he was, Keats was the creature of his London upbringing, believing in the thoroughfare of all thoughts and seeking, in spite of his illness, to stretch himself beyond deterministic constraints and narrowing contexts, limiting his growth, the growth of his imagination. His model was the myriad-minded Shakespeare, his term, who he admired for the variety and the mixed nature of his characters, as well as for the music of his language. Writing again to his brother George, that perhaps he takes us no further than this, that with a great poet, the sense of beauty overcomes every other consideration, or rather obliterates all consideration. Like any description of being or ontology, the multiple drafts model understands consciousness as taking time to occur. We don't experience our senses as fully realized, but rather as incremental impressions. Dennett, in fact, denies that there is any clear and unambiguous boundary separating conscious experience from all the other more autonomic and unconscious processing by our nervous system. According to Dennett, consciousness is the consequence of a network plurality of inputs associated with the action and flows of neural information. There is no singular personage, no dramaturg, no playwright assembling or framing our stories. No director, no central experiencer conferring her durable stamp on any of the drafts, let alone the finished version of the person who does the experiencing. While this may all be the case, our dispositions are inclined towards order. We prefer certainties to their opposites. And so if our several parts are endlessly gathering sensory details and evidence, our shape-giving desire for integration pushes us to see likeness and pattern because these exist and give us cues as to our whereabouts on one hand and significance on the other. We see what stands out, we remember what is more pronounced. Events that matter to us inevitably stay with us longer with their higher profile. Inevitably, as we mature as persons, these memories acquire the nature of a profile as we acquire a self-regarding sensibility, the autobiographical me of everyone's life. On one level, for something to reach the level of consciousness, is akin to becoming famous, in that the welter and chaos of our senses, an event must resonate sufficiently to be heard and recognized as worthy of being remembered. Put another way, consciousness is a property that has enough influence to affect what the ear hears and the mouth will say and the hands will do. It's probably the case that our dopamine sensors factor into this mix, bringing the brain's system of rewards and pleasure into the picture. Experiencing life is fun, and we often get a boost of energy and attention from its invigorating intensity. And I can second this by saying that I only know what I think when I'm able to tell it to someone, myself or someone else. Getting the feedback, it makes all the difference. So that what's edited into our drafts reinforces one experience over another, but always in accordance with the self-organizing, functioning network. And the brain and nervous system, which function beneath and across all that circuitry, is what brings us all this information and more, and all this information more or less bottom up. Finally, I would like not to be reductive about asserting either self or soul as something either transcendent or trivial. Both styles of interpretation miss the point of ambiguity, which I would argue is where the action is and is absolutely essential to experiencing the pleasure of meaning. The conscious self should thus be taken to possess a certain intentionality, even though its form is more found than deliberately fabricated. Nevertheless, this having been found reflects the potency of the inputs and their ability to create what Dennett refers to as the center of narrative gravity, the story we relate to ourselves about our experiences. Consciousness exists, but not outside a continuum of behavior and our behavioral disposition. Our autobiographical me thus emerges as a fiction derived from responding to the resonating stream of events and experiences that may or may not be fully connected to one another, but that awaken one's being and provide the content for our dreams. It is not that my fiction is false so much as it is the result of selection and a kind of editing, which in the end enables a pattern to emerge amid all that tapestry. Forever annoying for his sour disposition, the last word may still belong to T.S. Eliot. To be conscious, he wrote in Burned Norton, is not to be in time. Amen and blessed be.